Welcome to the Traditional Arts Indiana podcast, featuring interviews with craftspeople and artists from our residency series at the Mathers Museum of World Cultures in Bloomington. We are your hosts, Maria Zarang and Emily Burke.
In today's podcast, Director of Traditional Arts Indiana, John Kay, speaks with Sonkey maker Carol Powers and Rose Mahler, Jan Betcher. We hope you enjoy this interview, recorded in front of a live audience, as part of Indiana University's semester programming on the subject of beauty.
Good having everybody here today. We have two classes as well as some people from the community and from the campus, and so that's always great. My name is John Kay. First of all, I want to thank the College of Arts and Sciences for their program, Themester, which supports the ongoing theme of beauty here on campus. And I also want to thank the Indiana Arts Commission, who also chipped in some money so that we could have artists presented here as part of the campus celebration of beauty. We have with us two wonderful artists who've been doing a lot of programs with us around the state. This is an ongoing conversation that we've had hoop net makers, limestone carvers, and a variety of other traditional art. And so what we're going to do now is basically a narrative stage where basically I just have a short little conversation with both of these artists about their craft, where it came from, how it connects them to their community, what makes an egg beautiful, what makes a bucket pretty, those types of questions. So first of all, let's get to know our two artists here. I'll start with Jan. Your name's Jan Betcher.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about where you're from, your heritage, and how your art that you do relates to that. How about?
Okay. I'm originally from Wisconsin. I don't know if you can tell by my accent or not, I hope not. But my grandparents came from Norway and Denmark. And I remember my grandma very distinctly, but my grandpa died before I was born. But anyway, I was surrounded by many things Norwegian as I was growing up. And my mom told me many stories about her background and what her life was like when she was young and what different things meant to her. And she, even in just those comments she would make to me, I could see that she was always trying to tell me of her past and always bringing the past forward to me to, so that I would know it when I was, you know, when I needed it later in life. And that's where I'm at right now. I went back, going back to 1980, I started painting with my aunt in Wisconsin. She had gone to Decorah, Iowa, to the Vesterheim Museum there. And saw the display there and started taking classes, and then she brought them back to Wisconsin and was teaching there and explaining to people what it was. And really, it was brand new to the Americans. The Americans have since really taken off with it. It's very, very popular, and it's very well studied, and it's very Americanized. Most of the painting in Norway is pretty primitive, except for the more the better painters, the ones that were guild-trained. They were guild-trained as men there. They had to take a training of 3 years, and they would rotate their apprenticeship with different artists so that they could learn different angles of what they were learning. And then they would go out into the community and paint for their keep. They would stay in places, and they would feed them and give them a place to sleep and everything they needed as they painted. And then when their work was done, then they would move on to another job. It must have been kind of a lonely life, but that's what they did. And they, in turn, were sharing what they learned. So they would, it would be on display, and the many pieces that came to the United States that were painted over there were done by men, obviously, male-dominant culture, and many of them landed at the museum in Decorah, Iowa. So when we go to classes there, we study those pieces, and that's how we learn and how we create, because we're taking it that the next step.
Right. One of the things my students have been, we've been talking about is this the difference between the idea of like folk groups. You can think about Norwegian Americans having like a community. And probably if you up in Wisconsin, there was a strong community bounded with that. But then there's another way of thinking about traditional arts following networks, veins of people throughout that span different places, different times, over the different schools that you've gone to. Can you talk a little bit more? You've already been touching upon it, but this idea between this idea of it being associated with a local place versus this idea also of it kind of passing now in modern times through these kind of systems.
Sure. I have to say that in as far as the Norwegians go, their traditions and the way they did the painting stayed the same. They stayed within their community. Some of the painters would travel it back to the different valleys, but it was just an influence. It was never here. This is how they do it over in this valley. They kept very specific designs and colors and everything else. It's we as Americans that have taken those different designs and sent them out to different areas. Anybody that's interested, actually, and there's many people that are interested that don't even know what it is, but they get hooked on it because of the history or the appearance or their love for art or whatever it is. But it's a great way for us to show what Norwegians started, and now we Americans are kind of taking it and running with the ball and keeping it alive and showing people what it is.
That's great. Well, let's bring Carol in on the conversation here. You've already told the folks that when they came to see you as demonstrator, but there's also people who are not who weren't out there to hear your story about how you got introduced to this very Ukrainian art form. Can you describe the art form and say where it came from and how it relates to your life?
Okay. The art form is done in a petite method, and it is called pisanki, which means the egg is written on. It comes from the word pisat. These eggs are dyed. They're not painted, which is most people make a mistake about saying it's painted. The tradition comes from the Ukraine. My grandmother and grandfather both came to the United States from the Ukraine. They immigrated here in about 1908 at that time. My grandmother had learned this art from her mother, and she said that it's even from her grandmother. So I don't know who my second great grandmother would be, but I know it goes back quite a ways. And the styles of the eggs have changed. The different ways of doing a pisanki has changed over the years with new inventions and modernization. However, I try to keep a lot of it the traditional way. I was living in Chicago from the time I was 1 to 5 years, and then we moved to Marion, Indiana. I remember my grandmother always having eggs around the house, and it was very important to have an egg in your house all year through. And it meant that it was a protection that you would have. And she would do the eggs. A lot of times, I would just see her do the simple ones, but most of the time, she did it when everybody was asleep, so no one was around. And so after I was married, I was able to talk to one of my aunts who would spend some time with me, and she came over for a weekend, and she lived in Chicago at the time. She now lives in northern Indiana. And she sat with me and walked me through the steps, and she brought the dyes and brought the instruments that we use. And I worked 18 hours on my very first egg and broke it but at the end. But I was interested in my culture. I wanted to know who I was. And the things that my grandmother did, I knew that they wouldn't be kept alive if someone in the family didn't do something or learn it. And I do have a couple of cousins that dabble with pisanki work, but they don't go in very big detail. And this kind of bothered me, that I knew that it's going to die out. It's something I could take from my grandmother that I could keep and pass on to my children, which I did.
Yeah, about what year was it that you started seriously wanting to do it like that?
This has been 40 years ago that I started doing this. I just wanted the idea. I wanted to be able to do the eggs. All of you probably have done an Easter egg with the crayon, and then you put it in the dye, but you still have that crayon mark, the wax on it. This is similar, but I am taking one dye to another dye to another dye. I'm using a chemical dye, aniline dye, and I'm removing the wax afterwards. So this is something I wanted to pass on to my daughters, and they both take part in making pisankis. They know the ins and outs of it and how to do different designs. And then I'm working with other people who have shown interest. And believe me, when I get up with a fine art person, they can outshine me in my pisankis.
Oh, yeah? I find it kind of interesting that you're looking at right after the bicentennial era of the country. You probably were starting to get interested in this. There was kind of a window there between the late 70s and early 80s that people really started wanting to keep these older traditions alive, and there was a lot of emphasis on that. And I would say you probably had experienced the same thing with the Norwegian arts as well.
Right. You know, we go back to Chicago several times a year, and usually in the community my grandmother lived in, there was a lot of Ukrainians, so I would see other families having these eggs. They would even have an egg auction, and I would see these beautiful eggs and, you know, just desired to make one myself. And there was children, or I should say teenagers, making the eggs from other families, and I thought, oh, gee, look how great they are doing it, and I would love to learn this. And be able to do this.
Brought up an interesting point there. One being the fact that there's a community that you went to visit where there were lots of Ukrainians, and this was a vibrant tradition. Contrast that to your life as a Ukrainian in Marion, Indiana.
Totally different, because I'm in a farm area of Marion, so I can find the chicken eggs pretty easily if I want to. But as for the Ukrainians, there's only another family there who was from the Ukraine, and she dabbled with making pisankis. I've asked her how to do it, and if I had a problem. But they didn't have the festivals. They didn't have that would feature the eggs. The one thing Marion did have at one time, they did have the international festivals that they would hold from at the park, and they would have the different nationalities in this building, and they asked me to be there with the eggs, and so we were all displaying something that we learned from our culture. So that was one thing that I did do back in the 80s. However, I was the only one where, if I would go back to the neighborhood in Chicago, everybody was doing eggs.
Right, that's great. So there again, it's that idea of community versus networks of people. You were out on your own, and you would have to follow that circuit, that network, back to people who had the tradition and the knowledge. Let's come back to Jan, and your work is just beautiful. From an outsider, I can just look at it, and I see beautiful flowers on a bucket and on a box, and it would be enough for me to say, oh, yes, I want that to put on, that to give to my wife or to decorate my home. But to some people, they can look at these items, and they see something more. Can you talk about what our eyes should be seeing when we look at one of these pieces that you've brought here?
That's a good question. I think the basic thing that two things that are basic to rose mauling is the piece it's on. It's usually wood, and it's very traditional and kind of old world utilitarian type pieces. Very seldom that it's on anything that's extravagant. There was always a purpose for everything they needed for working or to earn a living. And I think that wood is probably the big factor there, because apparently they had a lot of wood to work with, because many of their pieces are wood, and many of the cool things that they created to help make their life easier as a utilitarian type piece were wood. My family came from an area that was noted for their wood, the Valdres Valley. It was one of the wealthier valleys, and it's not usually the rose mulling. It's the wood that they promoted, the cabinets and the, mostly cabinets, primarily cabinets that came from the area, and trunks. But I think how it fits on that piece and the colors that are used are specific to a certain piece. Each piece actually has a specific design, or I can look at a piece and think that's Oos, or that's Rogland, or that's Hallingdal, or whatever. They're very specific, even amongst the valleys, specific pieces that they created for certain things.
And so those names that you just said, those were places, actually. They're not just styles, but they're styles that are associated with places.
Exactly. They're called, the name is the name of the valley they came from. Hallingdal comes from the Hall Valley, and it got elongated to Hallingdal. Oos comes from the Bergen area, or Voss, Oos of the Bergen area. Oos and Voss are the two cities that we find it from. Rogland comes from Rogland Valley. They each are depicted from that valley. So they want it to be specific, and that's the way they teach it, too. And it's getting even more so that way here in America. I think they were a little bit freer to try different things in the valleys there, but in America we're trying to pin it down to this is from that valley, so we're kind of structured that way, which is good and can be bad, you know, right. As far as expression goes.
And where do your pieces come from?
My husband, he is just the best thing that ever happened to me all the way around for 50 years, and he does all my woodenware. I'll go to him and I'll say, Raj, can you make this and have it this long and that big and that round and put this groove here and I want a bead here and whatever? And he goes out in the shop and about, depending what it is, he brings to me the piece that I see in my head and then I can paint on. And it's just really cool. It just really is nice, special.
And he doesn't just make for you, right?
Nope.
Tell us about that network.
Right. Well, there's another situation that all goes back to rose mulling. I was rose mulling and we were always looking for woodenware sources, and I said to him one day, I said, can you turn a plate? Do you know how to do that? He said, well, I can learn. I said, well, what do you need? He says, well, I need a lathe. So we bought a lathe. And here he is in the basement of our little house making his first plate. And he started making me plates and different things. And I would take them to class and paint them. And somebody would say, where did you get that? And eventually, by word of mouth, they realized that Roger could do that. And we started a business in 2002. And it's been up and running ever since. We sell all over the world. All of our pieces, it all goes back to rose mulling. He learned how to turn. He did it all on his own. He learned how to be creative. He learned about the Norwegians, what they want, and listened to them. He knew what I wanted and what I liked, and so it helped him to get to the other painters. So we sell primarily to painters, to teachers mostly, and then they buy the plates or whatever they purchase, and they teach it in class, and then that kind of networks with more people to learn not only rose mulling, but that we supply the wood. So it's been special.
Can you tell us a little bit about the tools that you use to do the painting? Are they just regular paint brushes, or are they?
I have very, very specific brushes that I use. I'm very particular. Most people say they want sable brushes, but sable brushes are very, very expensive. So I do a few sable brushes, but mostly synthetics. The synthetics are just as good as the sables were before. But the painters that started this tied their own brushes, and so they also mix their own paints. We have the luxury of buying a tube of paint, and then we'd sit down, we've got the paint available to us, but they had to plan and get that all ready. But I use oil paints. I background in acrylic. All my backgrounds are acrylic, except for the larger pieces. Those are also oil-based. Yeah.
That's great. That's great. Look. Let's bring Carol back in here, and you use a special tool to do your eggs, don't you?
The traditional method is using a tool called a kiska, and it is basically a dowel rod that has a copper funnel inserted and wired with copper, and they come in three sizes, for coarse, medium, and a fine point. And that's the old method. The new method is electric one, which is, gives you and more even lines because it's always heated and the wax doesn't have a chance to cool. And with these, you will see that I could look at an egg and say, okay, this one was made with the regular Kiska, or this one was made with an electric Kiska. I can find the difference with that. You could even make this if you find an old pair of shoelaces, the old end that used to be metal. You could make a Kiska yourself and just put it in a dowel rod. So there's ways of getting around it.
An electric Kiska, that kind of sounds a little bit wild to me. Can you describe what an electric Kiska is and how it is better than a manual Kiska? We'll just say it that way.
The design reminds me of a small curling iron almost, but it does have a tip on it that is heated. The wax that you put in is dark. Where you've seen the beeswax that I use is the yellow color, or golden color. The wax that you use for a Kiska has already been blackened with carbon, so you can see your design. Otherwise, it comes out clear because there's no carbon from the flame getting into the wax. So it's very difficult to see. So if I would do the electric Kiska, I'm getting the a different type of beeswax with it. Or what I could do is use regular beeswax and kind of melt it a little bit so it does turn black, and I could put it into the electric Kiska. It comes in three sizes. I would need the coarse, the medium, and the fine for it. And it is expensive. They're about $35 a piece. So I have bought the set, and my daughter's using it because she's not able to have an open flame in her area. So they're now talking about having some with interchangeable tips, but those are fine too. But the electric Kiska is one of the changes that has come up in the development of making Tasankis. With it.
That's great. We ask Jan the question about the beauty of an egg and the fact that I can look at it and I can say, oh, that's just beautiful. I just love that. I could see that sitting on my mantle at home. But when someone is Ukrainian, they can look at it and they see something different. Can you maybe one of the eggs that you brought here, maybe you can just tell us the story of the egg. Might be nice.
Well, I brought my daughter's egg that she did when she was 15, mainly because it's large and you can see the designs on it. But the egg has some color, different colors. White would symbolize purity on it. Red would symbolize love. The color black was considered the darkest time before the dawn. And I've seen that so many times, saying the darkest time before the dawn with it. The green would be growth for the egg. Now, any design that goes completely around the egg, that would talk about everlasting. So it could be everlasting life, everlasting love, whatever purpose that the designer was thinking. The flowers, they represent love. However, the poppy on this one was the most admired flower in the Ukraine. So when a person would see the poppy on this egg, they would think immediately back to their homeland, that they would remember the poppies that were there in the Ukraine and the love that they had for their land. Up the top is a star, or it could be called a sun, but that would represent Christ in the Christianity, or the lightness of the earth. Triangles, I mentioned this earlier. Anytime there would be triangles, that could either be for the wind, fire, and water, or Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, or for the family of the father, mother, and child. Then there are fishnets on here. The interpretation that I know from that one is that of fishers of men for that. The wheat, prosperity. So there's love for the Ukraine, prosperity for the country is there. Talking about the family would be there. There's some ram's horns. These are swirls down at the bottom. That is called used for strength. So she was thinking about some strength for this egg. So an egg would have meaning. This one would be one that I would give to a newlywed couple. It has the goose on each side. A bird would represent fertility on each. So the flowers with the love and the fertility, the green for the growth. So this one would be very appropriate to give to a newlywed couple. We're going to go into the modern aspect of the Psanky. This one, I got the idea from Martha Stewart magazine. It has the flowers on it for the love. It has the vines going around for growth, and it has the netting for fishers to mend, but it also goes all the way around, so it shows for infinity or everlasting on it. So I have taken a modern looking Psanky and still holding the old traditions of what they stood for. The Indiana one, it's taking it most recently for our bicentennial, using the symbols and the dates that could be put on. I still have the love of the state, using with the flowers, the growth with the vines, and the wheat for prosperity for the state. So I'm continuing in that area. Here's one in the middle that has the rams, and it's on four sides, and that's staying with the strength. And then I have water, and that's looking like waves. So bringing the earth and the wind and the water, it's tying that in with it. And then we have the large ones where it shows this is also called the sun. So this would be one that would have something with Christianity involved. Any of the dots were considered the tears of Mary. The flowers were shown love. The bands going around, all the way around, would be showing the eternal life that there could be.
Let's turn back over to Jan here. So here you have this traditional art that you were introduced to by an aunt. It's very popular in the sense that you have lots of customers who are wanting your wares and that type of thing. How about the next generation? Is there anybody that you've been teaching that's you're kind of apprenticing or teaching classes in this? What's the future of rose mulling? Is it something that'll get put into a museum, or is it something that'll continue to grow and evolve and thrive?
That's a very good question, because I am seeing, just from what I am seeing, there are very few younger people that are going into rose mulling. It is primarily, I think it's because a lot of the younger people are working, and the older people, and you know, say 50 and older, are the ones that are now stepping back and saying, I really would like to do something interesting with my life. I'm going to check into this and try to do something different. I do teach, and I think that is extremely important to me, because I want to, you know, continue to talk about this and make people aware of the art, because it's a great way to learn your background and history. And I was listening to Carol talk, and many of the things she was saying about her eggs are so true of this art. So you know, those people in that particular part of time were trying to tell the younger people, this is what this means, this is what that means, this is why we do this. excuse me, why we do this, why we do that, this is the purpose of this or that. And that really does need to continue. I do teach, like I said, mostly older. I do have a brand new student coming up Saturday who's only 14, and I am thrilled, very thrilled. Her grandma is giving her a class for her birthday. And I think that that's, again, grandma trying to tell her how important something like this is to learn, to grasp onto, to take interest in, to, you know, to have important in your life. I think art is important, and any art is important as a way of expressing yourself and learning. And I learn every time I sit down and paint that that didn't work. Let's try this. I mean, you just are learning continually. And I think if you really read a lot about it, I do a lot of reading. And now with the internet, it's been so wonderful because we can tap into Norway, into their museums and things, and get information from them. But I really want to pass that on. I'm very passionate about that. I really want people to love it as much as I do, I guess is what I'm saying. And I want them to know the reason it exists. And I think that's important for anything in life. Why you're here, why you're doing what you do. You know, it's just an important thing in your life to check your roots, go back, find, learn, see that there were people before you that are probably going through the things that you are too right now, in a different time, in a different age, in a different manner. But that's the same with art. You know, when I look at some of the art in Norway, it's very primitive. And when we take it here and we've taken it and we've evolved it to something that's so much more Americanized, that's all I can call it, is Americanized. But it's just so important, you know, to learn your basics and learn what those meanings are, what the teardrops mean, what you can get in touch with what those people were trying to say to us and continue to say to us with their art.
I want to ask Carol the same question, but first I want to ask you one more thing. We talk about what it's going to give to the future. What has doing this done for you as someone who's pushing up against retirement now and having maybe a little more time on your hands than you haven't? Maybe you don't have more time on your hands. I don't know. What does having this creative practice mean to you as a person? Not as a Rose Muller or as a Norwegian, but as a person.
It gives me a reason to get up in the morning and a purpose in my life. It's just something that I continue to learn from. As long as you keep active and learning, I think that's the best thing that you can do after you're retired, especially. You know, keep yourself busy and learning and interesting. I don't know how everybody's interested in rose mulling, but to me, I want to present it so that you look at it in a different way, in a different light, and that makes me feel good.
That's great.
Carol, how about you? What's the future of this craft? Have you passed it on?
I have passed it on to my daughters, but I've noticed that in elementary books, especially Patricia Poloco, the author, she has mentioned this art in her children's books. And when I have done the festivals or when I have done classes, it's the children that recognize the art more than the parent, and the child will tell them. And some of the classes that I have taught, I see grandma bringing her granddaughter or grandson in, sitting with them. Grandma's not making the egg, but she's watching the child and directing them as I'm giving the instructions. And that gives me some idea that these children might continue, especially when I talk about the tradition. The traditional tools are not that expensive, and so they're not going to be out of a lot of money if something that's sitting around and will not be used again. Now, one thing that bothers me is the community that I visit up near Chicago, that the egg auctions that I used to go to when I was younger, they're getting scarce now. And before, like the one may have 50 eggs. And this last year, they had like 6 eggs. Mm. So they were really bidding high to get these eggs that the people wanted, but less people were actually taking the time. And our time, it does take time. The eggs are a time-consuming thing, but like the ones I had that looked like the Martha Stewart, they only take a half hour to do, and if I'm watching Dancing with the Stars for 2 hours, so I can get four of them made in that time.
Multitasking.
So it doesn't take too much time. And I was used to grading papers for years, so I can't sit still and just watch a TV show, so I have to do something. So this is one thing I can do.
And you're already answering the question. I'm going to ask the same question. As you just recently retired, a couple years ago now.
Four years ago now.
What has having this type of lifelong art, what does that help you in any way as you transition into retirement? Or
yes, I could put a different story down. I can use these eggs in many different ways, not only as gifts, not only as for Easter, but I am working on a series of eggs for Christmas ornaments. So I'm getting some of those done. And I have requests to have several of these eggs with the Christmas motifs of reindeers and trees, snowflakes, to use at a Christmas bazaar coming up.
Okay, fantastic. Well, I think we maybe have time for just a few questions here from the audience. Yes. The question is, because of as eyesight diminishes or problems you might have, do you have any special hacks for dealing with those issues?
Okay, I have contacts. One is for reading, one is for distance, so I'm working with that. But a lot of times I use a magnifying lamp to work with.
How about you, Jen?
I also have the contacts like Carol's, with one for reading and one for distance. But I also use just a cheap pair of glasses off the shelf at Walmart for a 1 or 1.25. And when I paint, I put those on. And that's just enough. And I don't seem to have any problems.
Okay.
If you would like to try this, I would suggest to go to UkrainianGiftShop.com. And you can order supplies there. The best way would be go get a kit, just a small kit that's probably $10. That would give you Kieska's wax, dyes, and instructions step by step, plus designs that you can go from the very beginning all the way to the end. And you could try that. The dyes will last up to a year. And it will tell you the do's and don'ts of working with Pasankis. And so it might be something that you might want to try. And you can personalize these any way I did an IU one and wrote the alma mater on the back. I did that for my niece when she graduated from here and gave it to her. So that is one of the things that you can do. You could change it just like I did with the bicentennial one. Or you can work on the ones that look like the Martha Stewart. So you can update it. You can use traditional things which will be in your kit. Or you can go with the modern and personalize it. And what is neat is to put your name on it, put the date on it, or put someone else's name and date. And these will last forever. You have a long time with these eggs.
Well, that's great. Let's give Jan and Carol a round of applause. Again, this is just a continuation in our conversation about beauty and about craft and what the folk arts are of our state. So I want to encourage you all to check out the themester listing. We have a lot more programs throughout the rest of the semester. So thank you all again.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you have enjoyed this podcast and will tune in next time for another set of interviews with folk artists from our residency series.
This podcast would not be possible without the support of the National Endowment for the Arts, the Indiana Arts Commission, and Indiana University's themester program.